And what a night we have in store for you tonight. In a moment, we're going live to the United Kingdom. Nigel Watson with us. His latest work, Captured by Aliens, A History and Analysis of American Abduction Claims. It's an amazing book in a series of great stories. Nigel is next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Nigel Watson, our special guest, his book Captured by Aliens. Nigel has researched and investigated historical and contemporary reports of UFO sightings back since the 1970s. He has published articles in 40 in Times, Fate, Flying Saucer Review, Magonia, and UFO Magazine. Is the author of UFOs of the First War, the UFO Investigations Manual, Captured by Aliens, A History and Analysis of American Abduction Claims. He lives in the United Kingdom. Nigel, welcome to the program. You were on our program about 5 years ago. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Time has flashed by.
How did you get interested in UFOs and alien abductions?
Well, it goes back to space exploration, and in 1969, you know, the papers were full of the Apollo moon landing mission and ultimately them landing in July 1969. And I was a teenager then, and, the pictures on TV were really striking, and I started cutting out anything I could find out about space exploration from the newspapers, and reading every book I could get out of in the local library. And that kind of led me to picking up UFO books, basically. And then it was a downward spiral. You know, I got fascinated then by the fact that, you know, if we could go to the moon, then aliens who were sort of thousands of years in advance of us could easily have visited us. So it all began from that, really. And I began collecting sort of UFO reports from the local area, from local newspapers, and then it progressed to actually going to see people and interviewing them, and setting up a local UFO group as well. So at that time as well, there's no internet, but there's quite a thriving industry of amateur UFO magazines. So I subscribed to Flying Saucer Review and got hold of any other sort of magazines I could get hold of.
Two events, Nigel, shaped my interest in UFOs when I was a youngster. My mother brought me home a book called We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan, who at the time was the New York Times science writer. But the one that really captured my attention was when she brought me a copy of a magazine we used to have published in this country called Look Magazine that had The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller on the cover, the story of Barney and Betty Hill, the abduction case. And I read that as a little boy, and I was hooked. I mean, I went, this is incredible. I couldn't get enough. Well, to tell you a great story, when I got my radio job, I was 21 years old in Detroit, Michigan, and I was interested in UFOs. I had interviewed the late Stanton Friedman, the great ufologist, and stuff like that. But I was so into the Barney and Betty Hill story, I called their psychiatrist, who was still in Boston and still alive, Dr. Benjamin Simon, and I interviewed him for a show on UFOs that I was doing, and I talked to him about the Betty and Barney Hill case. I've been ripping my house apart trying to find that tape from 1971. I can't find it. But I asked him a specific question, and I said, were they telling you the truth? And he said, and I'll always remember it, he said, George, I hypnotized both of them separately. They both said the same thing. I don't know if they got abducted by extraterrestrials or aliens. I don't know that. But I do know this. Whatever happened to them, they believe it to be true. And that's an incredible story all by itself.
Yeah, I've read that. He was skeptical, and I think at every point he tried to break down their story, but they always stuck to their guns, really, and never deviated that much from their original story. And I think that's the thing, that he was a medically qualified hypnotist. And I think at least his research is very reliable, and it's perhaps been used far more loosely in more recent years to hypnotically regress people. And it's also interesting that he was actually hypnotically regressing them because Barney had various stress-related issues. So I think we were trying to do it to reduce anxiety rather than, you know, to ferret out a UFO abduction case. Although that was something at the back of their minds, because Betty had had a series of nightmares after their original UFO encounter, and she'd had these nightmares about being medically examined by aliens. So it's something lurking in the back of her mind, and I think she wanted to find out more about it, but I think Barney was more circumspect about it and just wanted to let matters lie. But obviously that kind of, by him repressing whatever had happened, was causing physio problems with his you know, he was having warts and just worries and things. So I think in a way it inevitably led to hypnotic regression for you know, to get over the trauma of whatever had happened.
Your latest book, Captured by Aliens, has a foreword by the late British expert on the UFOs, Peter Rogerson, who passed away. He's not with us anymore. But he was one of the most learned English scholars on the subject of UFOs, wasn't he?
Yeah. I got in touch with him in the early 70s because he started doing an international catalogue of what Jacques Vallée called Type 1 cases, which are basically landings or UFOs close to the ground. And he wrote an appeal for people to contact him in Flying Saucer Review, so I wrote him a letter. And from then on, we kept in contact. He'd often ring up on a Sunday and we'd speak for 2 or 3 hours about the latest UFO cases or anything crossing our minds, really. But the thing is, he lived in Manchester and he was a librarian, and he just collected this vast amount of UFO books and books related to the paranormal. And he cross-referenced all the books for his catalogue of UFO cases, which is now online on the sort of Magonia website. And that's worth looking up if anyone wants to Google it, because it covers, I think, cases from over the last 100 years, really, and up to the last sort of 10, 15 years. And the thing is, with such a collection, there's always new information coming up all the time, or stuff that never came out, you know, like with your interview with Dr. Benjamin Simon. There's still stuff buried away, which is quite handy for modern researchers.
Sure is, absolutely. And but Rogerson had an influence on you, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he and I were sort of influenced by writers like John Keel, who suggested UFOs aren't extraterrestrial, but he put forward the theory that they were ultra-terrestrials, that they kind of moved in and out of our dimension, really, I suppose. And that they've always been here with us through folklore and religious periods. But we kind of looked more at the psychological and sociological aspects of UFO cases. So, in a way, we didn't particularly have to prove whether, say, Betty and Barney Hill had actually seen something. We looked at more of the implications of what people believed has on society. And, like, the belief in the Betty and Barney Hill case has helped evolve the old belief in alien abductions. And, you know, I think that's why I use them as a focus on my book, because their case is such a milestone, which you can trace from then to modern day research. And also you can see the kind of strands of influence on their case as well. Because I think their case didn't really come to public knowledge until about 1965. And ufologists weren't that eager to publicize such cases because the flamboyant contactees of the 1950s had kind of poisoned the well, and serious researchers kind of avoided anything that involved contact with aliens. And
was it considered too foolish at that time?
Yes, I think it just seemed too fantastic. And
well, we had the stories of like George Adamski, who claims he was picked up and taken to Venus and brought back. And I could understand how a lot of people would think, geez, or there's that other story of the Venusian Valiant Thor who came here.
Oh, yeah.
and so we had those kinds of things going on at the time in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
So I could understand how a lot of people would be suspicious of abduction stories.
Yeah. I think the contactees had probably a bigger influence in the United States. In Britain, we didn't have so many of those type of cases or, you know, big conventions and things like that. I think Adamski is quite fascinating, though, because after he died, somebody in Britain claimed he saw a UFO land, and the occupants was the reincarnation of George Adamski. He called himself Yamski. But I think the case was probably a hoax, and the person was perhaps... he'd read too many UFO books, really, and it kind of influenced his mind. But I must admit, reading stories like that really intrigued me, because anyone could just step out the house in the morning and perhaps be abducted or meet aliens, whereas, you know, the other more serious books were kind of like dull statistics of lights in the sky. And I suppose that's a problem with lights in the sky. We don't really, you can investigate them for, you know, months, if you like, and you never really pin down what it might be, you know. Whereas if somebody meets an alien, you know, it's something a bit more tangible to investigate. But then, having written this book, I think whenever you look at any type of encounter, there's always ambiguities and questions, and so it is really hard to pin down information and facts as to whether people actually did you know, meet aliens. Like in the case of George Adamski, originally people thought he was having physical contacts, but later on somebody said he was often going into trances, where he said he was meeting aliens. And George Adamski had always looked down upon people who said they'd had trance experiences with aliens. So I think he kind of lost a lot of followers through that, really.
What was it about the Barney and Betty Hill case that captured your attention, Nigel?
Well, first of all, it seems like it's credible. They're driving late at night to kind of get distracted and lost, but followed by a UFO. And then the details of it, of them being stopped by aliens and dragged inside, and the medical procedures, it just sounds like something aliens visiting us would do, you know, would find out about people. And yeah, it just sounded like a sort of spaceship that you would expect, really. It's something, you know, at that time as well, there'd been a lot of flying saucer movies, things like The Day the Earth Stood Still and This Island Earth, and invaders from Mars. And it kind of, the spaceship and the scenario kind of fitted in with the sort of things that had already been in movies and television. And it just seemed credible. And also that, you know, Benjamin Simon had obtained all this information, and it just seemed, you know, that it could be something that could have happened. But I think it's very hard putting down any physical evidence for it. I know there were sort of stains on Betty's dress, and apparently there was a radar observation of something unusual that night, but can't really be pinned down to what they actually saw.
Yeah, something happened to them, and they got a lot of media attention at the time. I remember Tom Snyder, who was one of our late-night television talk show hosts in this country, Nigel, interviewed Betty Hill, and it got a lot of publicity. And it had happened, what, about 20 years before the Kenneth Arnold 1947 sightings in Roswell, New Mexico, that crash scene?
Yeah. Yeah. It was about 14 years after that, yeah, when it actually happened. But it was about... It took about 3 or 4 years for it to actually surface. I think actually NICAP, the civilian organization, had wrote a web investigate the case, but even that wasn't published until something like 1965 as well. And so in a way, I think civilian organizations like NICAP were a bit dubious about actually publicising the case. But I think with John Fuller publishing the interrupting
Yeah, well, that's what put it on the map.
That's it. And it was a worldwide thing as well. I think it had a big influence on Britain as well, and kind of set the whole agenda for alien abductions. And I think that's why it's so important. And there's so many strands to it in terms of, you know, did they really have missing time, or did they just get lost? And, you know, was it a dream or a fantasy or something more? It's interesting, like, if I go back to Adamski, some people theorise that he and other contactees were being manipulated by the CIA or other nefarious agencies to find out whether they had communist sympathies and what other propaganda they might be spreading. So there's the implication that the CIA might have investigated or even manipulated them.
Or even faked them, right? Even faked some of them.
Yeah. And also, like, I think one ufologist, I think it's called Leon Davidson, said that Adamski was put, when he went on all these space trips, he was actually in a simulator with film screens and perhaps even drugged to make it seem like he'd actually had a journey. But I think the CIA might have been involved with that sort of thing, particularly, you know, monitoring contactees, because a lot of them were spreading, like, communist stories and, you know, were sympathetic to a more a different type of society from, you know, from our own. And also with a Cold War, you know, it's important to see, you know, if there were any, you know, people plotting against the state. But I think the thing with the Betty and Barney Hill case is it was a completely random event, really. They'd gone to Canada on a whim. They came back because there was a hurricane
Hold on for a second, Nigel. We're at a break, but we'll come right back and talk more about your work, Captured by Aliens. And welcome back. We're back with Nigel Watson as we talk about his latest work, Captured by Aliens. Nigel, what is it about the Benny and Barney Hill case that convinces you that this might be real?
Well, they didn't contradict themselves, and it was something that couldn't have been staged because, you know, there were being followed 24 hours or something. And I don't think it could have been staged. The only thing is that whether it was a product of her imagination, you know, something perhaps on that night they'd seen a UFO following them. And when they stopped the car to have a better look at it, Barney Hill grabbed a pair of binoculars and went out of the car to get a better view of the UFO. And he said he saw a craft with a row of windows in it, and he could see occupants inside the flying saucer. One of them looked like the leader, and he looked really sinister, you know, like compared him to sort of a Nazi soldier or something.
Like a stormtrooper or something.
Yeah, and that really frightened him, and I think he was frightened that they would land and capture them. So I think it's at that moment he kind of ran back to the car and drove off really fast, and that's when they kind of got lost. And the next thing, that they were kind of home, but like the workout, that was like about 2 hours missing time. And that's when you know, Betty's nightmares kind of fill in some of those gaps, and then it's not really until under hypnotic regression they really get to the bottom of what might have happened. It's interesting, though, on the craft itself, that they're separated, and that seems to always happen with abductees. If there are two, they always seem to get separated. So it's hard to collaborate with stories, really, other than that they entered and left. And the scene, like with Betty, they inserted a needle into her navel, and with Barney, they tried taking his first teeth out. So
they were fascinated by his teeth, weren't they?
Yeah, they were like curious sand efficient people, and more than say, and also they didn't look like the typical greys of ufology nowadays. And with Betty, she actually had a discussion with them, and she saw the famous star chart on the wall, and she even tried taking a book as a souvenir, but it's taken off her. And so that's another problem with people who are abducted. They're never allowed to take anything away from the ship. And that's very much like, you know, ancient fairy stories where people enter fairyland and then they never are able to take anything out of that land to prove they'd been there. So I think it was literally the stuff of nightmares. And also, Benjamin Simon felt that a lot of their problems were caused by racial tension, that they were Mr. and Mrs. Average. They were an interracial couple, which was quite unusual for the early 60s. And Peter Rogerson equates the UFO to almost being like a symbol of a pirate ship, and the fear of being taken away and abducted, sort of repercussions of and echoes of, you know, slavery in the past. The Mayflower Pilgrims represented, you know, an exploring culture into the United States. This, and in a way, this spaceship represents another exploring civilization that might, you know, take over their own country, and had sort of echoes of, invasion as well.
And a lot of times, too, Nigel, when something like this happens, yeah, you've got to ask the question, who benefits? And the Hills didn't benefit from going public with this at all. This was not in their best interest to do this, was it?
No, they're well thought of in their community. I think Betty was a social worker, and Barney had been involved with like the community action program.
Yeah, they were well liked.
Pardon?
People liked them.
Yeah, they were well liked. They were they worked for different associations. They were quite. They weren't like shut off from society and sort of fantasy prone in that sense. And I suppose in a way, because of Barney wanted to keep it quiet, but I think Betty was a far more outgoing person. And in a way, and because of the interest in their case, I think she was willing and able to, you know, talk about it in public and go on TV and present it in a credible way. And, you know, even though Barney was reluctant about all this, he did kind of support it. He did support her claims through his own hypnotic regression. So, in a way, it's just their own human reactions to whatever happened to them. And I think as well, at that time, the Soviet Union had just started nuclear testing, and that was something high in people's minds. And it's interesting that when Betty got home the early hours of the morning, she was very fearful about radioactivity, and I think they cleaned the car out and did different things because they were so worried about that. And I think that's one reason why she reported the UFO sighting to the nearby Air Force base, because she was worried about, you know, that were being contaminated by radiation.
Well, in those days, too, they didn't know who to report UFO cases to, so going to the Air Force was probably the right thing.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was a hard thing to know about. And I think she also rang her sister, because her sister had seen a UFO in the past, so she got some advice off her. I think she ended up going to a library the same way I did, and she got the address of Donald Kehoe, and that's how a case got to be investigated by NICAP. But I think she was the sort of person who was inquisitive, so I think she kind of read a lot of UFO books and contacted different people to find out more. So, you know, I think it was interesting there that, you know, she got to the right people, really, so that Walter Webb wrote quite an extensive report on her case, which wasn't really, I don't think it was really out until about 1965, and that also had a lot of references to South American cases, particularly the Anthony Villas-Boas case, which he gives about 5 or 6 pages to, because he thinks it seems very similar to the Hill case. With Villas-Boas, he had aliens who pointed to the sky and then to themselves, implying they weren't from this planet. So in a way, that was a bit like the equivalent of Betty Hill's star map, that they reference themselves to something extraterrestrial, you know, rather than something, you know, more mundane. And also the fact that
The Dogon tribe.
Pardon?
The Dogon tribe would point to the Sirius star system, for example.
Yeah. So, in a way, these were very similar cases that were spread by, you know, continents, separate continents. But, you know, it's possible the Hills, you know, might have heard a bit about that case through Walter Webb. But I think the Villas-Boas case was kept in the background for quite a while, and then that got publicity in 1965, really, in the English-speaking world, about the same time as the Betty and Barney Hill case became well-known as well. So I suppose, in a way, that kind of broke down the barrier to accepting abductions by, you know, more serious ufology.
What other cases did you look at, Nigel, that captured your interest?
I looked at the sort of Betty Anderson case and the cases that evolved after the Hill case, and also the Travis Welton case as well, you know, famously.
That's a great case.
Yeah.
Fire in the Sky.
Yeah. It's a very good film because I think it sort of balances some skeptical viewpoints as well as his, you know, kind of horrifying encounter. And I think that's probably one of the better alien abduction movies ever made. And with that case, it was missing for about a week rather than two hours. And, you know, we still don't really know what went on in that such a long period of time on board the spacecraft. But this case seems a bit more horrifying than what the Hills went through. And, of course, cases that came up in the 80s and 90s, I think weren't so much focused on particular people, but more the investigators like Bud Hopkins and John Mack and David Jacobs, who kind of plotted more of the characteristics of, you know, maybe 100 or so abduction cases rather than focus on particular instances. So, but they kind of established such things as missing time and implants and being floated up to a spaceship and the kind of things that are accepted in ufology now. And it's quite interesting, though, the cases after the Hills, really, involve people being floated up to flying saucers like Travis Welton, Travis was, or even floated through windows or walls to go to a UFO, whereas with Antonio Villas-Boas and the Hills, they were both sort of dragged unceremoniously into the craft. So they were kind of like low-tech versions of more modern UFOs.
What fascinates you about all these cases? Because there's a breeding program underway with this too, isn't there?
There's a sort of, particularly with Villas-Boas, it was kind of forced to have intercourse with a space woman. I was quite surprised to learn, though, that some Brazilian investigators went back to his hometown, and one of the locals who knew Antonio said that the space woman was very ugly, whereas all the reports of it that I've seen before is that she was a kind of beautiful, seductive alien woman. So it's a bit of a surprise that apparently she was ugly. And, you know, that just shows how things get repeated in the literature until you kind of go back to the sources and find out what else has gone on. So in a way, that kind of undermines the idea that it was some sort of male fantasy, because, you know, who'd admit to that with an ugly person, in a way. So that put a different perspective on that case. But it also seems like they were used in for a breeding program. And with the Betty and Barney Hill case, they were kind of interested in their reproductive organs, and you know, it seems like the aliens seem to have a deep interest in how we breed. And
well, do you think that they want knowledge of our breeding program for themselves or to replace us on this planet?
Well, it seems to be a mixture of them wanting to breed with us to create hybrids. I suppose this comes from like the concept of way back when people believed there was life on Mars. They always thought the Martians would come and invade the Earth because they had a lack of water and resources, and they were dying out, so they needed to come and invade here and perhaps even breed with us to make stronger stock. And in a way, that seems to be what people think about the alien breeding program, that we want to come here to either revitalize the dying alien stock, or they want to create an entirely new hybrid to take over the planet. But it's really hard to say, really, because, you know, some of it, I think, particularly some of John Matt's cases are probably more fantasy than real, but it has led to people, you know, speculating about what any alien agenda might be. But I suppose another thing with the sceptical point of view is the fact that their techniques seem to be quite crude, really. Like people said, oh, why don't they just, you know, break into a medical laboratory and steal, you know, samples and things like that. You know, why plague and rape people, you know, such a sort of...
It's bizarre. Nigel, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Nigel Watson with us. His book is called Captured by Aliens. He's got another one out that's also called UFO Investigations Manual, UFO Investigations from 1982 to the present day.